here with you this morning. And if you would like to organize yourself, there's a handout, and we'll be studying exclusively from Romans 12 today. If you want to get those two open and make yourself comfortable. We won't study Romans 12 in sequence, but we will cover the entire chapter during the presentation today. I am so grateful to talk to you because I get to talk about one of my favorite subjects, which is the life of early Christian women. The photos that you're going to be seeing today are from statuary and frescoes from the time period of the early church, around the 1st to 4th century. There are a few paintings interspersed from the 18th century that'll be easy for you to determine which are those. But the rest of them are all artifacts that are from the early Christian period that I have been able to bring and share with you. The only thing I can compare my excitement for this subject to is my passion is very similar to what my friends describe as their passion for chocolate. It is absolutely a thrill and electricity for me to discuss this subject because I think that we can learn so much from those who've gone before us. So actually, I guess now we can have the lights off. Thank you so much. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the tender mercies of God, to present your bodies as living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. And don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you, by testing, can discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. That is what the Holy Spirit asked the Apostle Paul to share with the Romans and with us to this day. For 500 years, the Roman Empire dominated the world. You see the red area. What we know of as the Mediterranean Sea was actually called the Roman Lake. As Rome conquered all of its neighbors and gobbled up their wealth and resources. Every emperor sought to enhance his own legacy, acquiring more territory and money, and the Roman world flourished with everyone with power and in every vice that fuels those evils. The lust for wealth, indulgence, and greed of these men would occupy a hospital full of psychologists. These are the remnants of statues built by emperors to extol their greatness. I apologize for the tourist in the photos there, but I'm there to show you the great size of these statues, what remains of these statues, and the egos of the driven men who built them to bring glory to themselves. Loyalty, hard work, and patriotism were what was expected of Roman citizens. But in reality, greed fueled every decision. Within centuries of the Roman Empire, of Rome's history, it would be hard to find a leader who led a moral life, or find an emperor who died of natural causes. Wealth was the virtue of Rome. Three firm classes existed in Roman society. Let me see, I didn't see your name tags. Do they have the designations on them? Can you see whether you're a patrician or a plebeian or a slave? All right, here we go. You can see by designation or by birth, you are assigned a class in the Roman Empire. The patricians, about 10% of society, inherited their wealth, their family name, and their status. All of the laws and rights protected them. Plebeians were the working class. They scratched out a living as soldiers or farmers or merchants. And the slaves. Most came to Rome as prisoners of war, and they were from every race. Slaves were the back and the power and the labor of the empire. Every brick, every archway built in the Roman world was cut by a slave. Cheating was the way of doing business in the Roman Empire. Every superior stole from his subordinates. Every subordinate accepted bribes from both sides. And altogether, they exploited the everyday man. Rome was a society of predators. This was the world of Rome's greatness. In the Roman world, when a child was born, the midwife set the baby on the ground. If the father went over and picked up the baby, it was accepted as its own. If not, it was exposed, deliberately abandoned. There were spots in each town where babies could be left, and they were frequented by slave traders. Women had no legal rights over themselves or their children. Fathers could sell their children of any age into slavery. For the wealthy patrician, about 10% of the population, everything existed to please them. So how many of you have a name tag that says patrician on it? Ah. Back table took the patrician name tags. They must have figured out what that was right away. You live a life of luxury, wealth, and privilege. Pontius Pilate would be a New Testament example of a patrician. A patrician boy would be educated and cared for by a tutor, a nurse, and a staff of slaves. He was groomed to take his place in business or politics and advance his family's wealth and status. His education was in Greek, mathematics, and the ways of indulgence, wine, women, and treachery. Patrician girls were raised in a strange sort of double standard of homemaker values, and yet they were taught to attract men loaded with makeup and fancy hairdos and clothing. This is the wife, one more slide. This is the wife of Domitian. He was so paranoid of assassination, and with good reason. He had all of the hallways and the floors, the marbles, ultra polished along the Palatine, so he could see assassins coming from any angle. Well, in the end, his wife is the one who killed him. Roman girls were married by 12 years old. The dowry and the political advancement of their fathers being the only reason for their marriage. Classic funerary inscription of a woman named Vittoria said that she was married at age 11, gave birth to 6 children, and died at age 27 in childbirth. That's reality of a Roman woman's life. A mother's job was to prepare her children to be cives Romani, or Roman citizens. Infertility was grounds for divorce. Aristocratic families wanted sons to carry on their name. Children of wealthy families were cherished and spoiled beyond our imagination. But families that did not want to provide a female newborn's dowry simply exposed her. She couldn't inherit name or property, so she was useless other than in marriage. Divorce and remarriage was common practice of patrician families. It was not uncommon for Romans to be married 5 times in their lives, married and divorced 5 times in their lives. Marriage for men was to acquire a dowry and enhance their social or political status. It had nothing to do with monogamy or love. Roman men and women commonly had adulterous affairs. Only legitimate heirs could inherit the family fortune, so marriage delineated who inherited what. Remember, monogamy came from Christian values. It was a common practice for a Roman man to lend his wife to a dinner guest for sexual pleasures for an evening or an extended period of time. In exchange, the man might receive a desired business deal or a sum of money. In contrast, male dominance was shown by taking another's wife sexually. Some of you know the Julius Caesar story where he's being murdered in the Senate and all the senators are gathered around on the Ides of March. He looks up at Brutus and says, "A tu, Brute." Well, in that moment was the knowledge between those two men. Julius Caesar had taken not only Brutus's wife, but his mother sexually in order to show his male dominance. Marriage laws constantly were being reformed by the Senate because there were so many problems in society, you think? One law stated that a girl's marriage was only valid as long as her father, who had arranged the marriage, as long as her father lived. But when there was a big increase in patricide or father killings, that law was abolished. All right, plebeians. How many of you are plebeians? Raise up your hand. All right. You're about 50% of the people of the Roman world. Think of Cornelius and Lydia of the book of Acts as the best of the plebeian class. Some plebeians thrived in a trade or in business, others barely surviving as sharecroppers. There was little marriage among plebeians when there wasn't property at stake, which left millions living out their entire lives in fornication and promiscuity. Plebeians were the working class of the empire, the bakers, the farmers, the soldiers. Soldiers got paid by pillaging the territories they conquered, and there were no rules for their behavior. They were forbidden to marry and spent their lives fighting to keep the empire rich. Keeping conquered territories under control demanded a heavy hand, as once free people were now the property of the empire. Soldiers maintained order in the provinces and fought for new territories in Germany and beyond. All right, slaves, raise your hand. I did this activity with my Bible class this last quarter. I taught third and fourth grade the book of Acts, and we wore togas on Wednesday night, and whoever got there first got to be the one plebeian. Boy, I had people there on time. And then the next three that came were, that got to be the patrician. The next three that came were the plebeians, and then the last ones, of course, were the slaves. So you want to up your Bible account, class attendance, divide people, patrician, plebeian, and slave. Here we go. You see that just by an accident of birth or by being conquered, your status is established. About 40% of Roman society were slaves. There was no racism in slavery. Ethnic prejudice for Germans or Thracians was ever present. Jewish slave traders followed the Roman army to purchase the best of the new captives. This was the number one profession of Jews in Rome. When Julius Caesar won a great portion of Gaul, which we call France, 53,000 slaves were brought back to Rome in that single campaign. These are people like us who had lives and homes and businesses and things like that, scooped up. We want to colonize this with Romans. Vernae, or second generation slaves, were the most desirable because they had been raised to be submissive and they didn't require as much discipline and punishment as newly acquired slaves did. This is a rare fresco. No one does paintings of slaves. This is a rare fresco from a kitchen in Pompeii of these two slaves preparing dinner. Slaves were considered to be inferior beings, spoken to in terms used for pets or children. Regardless of age, they were termed as little boy or little girl, even if an old man or woman. Some slaves became highly skilled in arts of mosaic or metalworks. Very intelligent slaves functioned as researchers or advisors. But most slaves staffed the homes and businesses of the empire, working throughout their lives at whatever was chosen for them. And there were no laws to protect them. By its nature, slavery was filled with abuse. Slaves might have cutesy pet names like Rover or like my cat's name, Tinkerbell. You see these slaves wearing masks and entertaining at a party in this rare mosaic. Slave women were the lowest of all society. A slave woman was used and abused by every man of the home throughout her life. Because of this, slave women were frequently the victims of their mistress's anger. One mistress in a journal is said that she beat her slave to death because she did not curl her hair properly. Slave women bore children to whomever sired them and had no say as to their destiny. A kindly master might keep slave children that he had sired, as one keeps a favorite pet, dress them up in character costumes for entertaining. It was the master's choice to raise his slave children or expose them or drown them as unwanted kittens. Slave traders picked up babies from pagan temples or dumps and provided a steady stream of girls to be raised for work or prostitution. The ruins of the empire are found in every country of Europe. I have eaten my lunch here on Hadrian's Wall in northern England, imagining the soldiers working in the fortresses there. And I've walked through this Roman bath in northern Germany. When I was 19, driving through Germany with some family friends, we happened upon this bath, and it was like electricity going through my veins. I did not want to leave. But all of these places are ruins. You have to use your imagination to figure out what has been destroyed, because when civilizations come, people destroy what has gone on before them, except for one city. To learn about Roman life, we go to the ancient city of Pompeii. With peaceful Mount Vesuvius in the background, nowhere on earth can you go to see a 2,000-year-old moment in time. One day, August 24th, 79 AD, 20,000 people lived in the city of Pompeii. Mount Vesuvius began to rumble. Now realize, people had no idea of what a volcano was. There was no word in Latin for volcano. They had no idea that such a thing even existed or what it would do. After 6 hours of earthquakes, most people left the city, but 5,000 people remained behind, perhaps in disbelief, perhaps not comprehending, perhaps to guard properties from looting. Some died clutching bags of their gold, guarding their riches with their last breath. And in one 13-minute surge of poisonous gas and ash, some huddled together with their idol gods in their hands, or fleeing with things they once thought as precious, gasping as hot gas and ash made wet cement in their lungs. 5,000 souls suffocated and were petrified in time, leaving us a precious time capsule ready for opening. As you walk the streets of Pompeii, you see frozen in time, a day in the life of the Roman world. Lives immortalized in concrete for 2,000 years. All of a sudden, the history of the empire is in color. Frescoes painted into the walls, preserved from the volcanic ash. You see roads where chariots rolled. You can see this is a two-way road because there are stepping stones here for chariots to go in two directions. The roads were all filled with sludge and sewage and muck, so these pedestrian stepping stones were very important to get across the street. You can see how chariot wheels would have fit across those stones to make a two-way road. And in this one-way chariot road, you can see over the hundreds of years that this city existed, the stone is actually worn down from chariot wheels over the centuries. An acoustically designed Roman amphitheater shows the high importance of arts in this culture. And an early version of our hometown buffet called Tavola Calda, you can see there would have been great fires of coals underneath here, and then pots of food placed into each one of these holes to be served to the restaurant guests. Found in every neighborhood, Tavola Calda. A little working fresco on the wall there. You can almost smell the warm bread from the bakery with its great ovens and grinders, and an amazing fresco of the plebeian baker and his wife. a 2,000-year-old painting from the walls of this exact shop. It is so rare and famous. It adorns the covers of books and logos all over the world. As you look in their eyes, you can see them poised for service. She has at her lips a stylus that would have carved numbers into these wax tablets that she's holding, perhaps keeping the books for their bakery. The portrait is from the wall of the bakery and would have been their advertising logo. You see a couple ready for work. As you walk along the exact streets with the exact stones where people walked on that last day, oh, there's that annoying tourist again. You walk into the homes just as they were left, and you see smooth utensils and their daily diet immortalized in mosaics. This beautiful courtyard stands just as it was when the mistress walked the hallways and enjoyed her garden. And this famous fresco is one of my favorites, of a beautiful young girl, pensive, with her stylus at her lips, before writing down a delicate thought. And family life of wealthy women at play. What we learn from Pompeii is, what were the priorities of typical people? You can see this family making music together. And this is a very rare fresco of an aging man with his two daughters. The elderly were not revered in Roman culture, so this is very, very rare. There were 20 to 30 brothels, or houses of prostitution, in a city of 20,000 inhabitants. Actually, there are so many buildings excavated with pornography painted on the wall, it's hard for archaeologists to determine exactly how many are brothels. I must admit to feeling quite sad when I peek through the doors of this brothel to think, can you see right there with the light? Little cubbyhole rooms. To think of the young slave girls who gave their entire lives here, dying young of sexually transmitted disease, with no choice, making money for some greedy man. This brothel is located next to the laundry, as they thought if they boiled the sheets, it would prevent the spread of venereal disease. The Naples Archaeological Museum, which holds all of the frescoes and artifacts from Pompeii, contains a special lascivious room, extra admission price to go in there, to see 2,000-year-old nudity and pornography, which I appreciate because I don't want to go in there. But it's interesting to me, if Italian museum curators understand what is lascivious, Galatians 5:19, sensuality, it's amazing sometimes we do not. Idol worship was a part of daily life, as you see in this remnant of the Temple of Apollo. Like all things in the Roman Empire, idol worship was driven by sex, money, and control. Idol gods were tailor-made for effect from this gigantic goddess Juno that would have graced a temple to small household gods placed on these lararium or household altars. Some of the bodies excavated in Pompeii were found crowded around these lararians with their little idols in their hands, praying to Jupiter or Isis to save them. Idols were created for a market. Do you remember the silversmiths in Acts 19:28 hollering, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians"? Well, here are two versions of the goddess Artemis. This one from a temple near Ephesus, created for more of an Eastern style market. This one, Artemis, is for Roman girls. Idol worship is highly visual. The vast majority of people could not read, and they were struggling a living out of the dirt. So these beautiful temples and visual glories were powerful. You can see how the inventors of the Roman Catholic denomination took advantage of this tradition of having idol statues in homes and in grand cathedrals in worship. Pagan ceremonies were choreographed to get the worshiper to give of themselves and their money. You brought of your profits, you brought of your grain to the temple. For men, you gave money to have sexual relations with the temple priestess. A lot of money got you fornication with the temple high priestess. When Romans conquered Bath, England, they found that the local people, the Celts, worshipped a hot spring goddess called Sewell. Noticing the similarity to their Roman goddess Minerva, they just created a hybrid goddess, Minerva Sewell. Your idol plus my idol, we can all get along. Here's what's exciting. They've excavated petrified curses from this hot spring. As part of Roman worship, they would wish vengeance on someone for an offense and throw their curse deep into the sacred pool. I hope that Valerius dies the death of a thousand bloody sores for what he has done to me. Idolatry is a belief, is a religion built on prayers of revenge, for my God to make you die because of some offense. How incredibly difficult for these people to convert, to love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you, do good to those who spitefully use you. Loving and giving was foreign to them. Remember, Rome is a society of predators. The resplendent Arapaces of Augustus has just been unveiled in Rome. This was the high altar on which the oxen was laid and his throat was cut. The blood actually poured down these steps right here to appease the fake deity. This is the metaphor the Lord uses for us in Romans 12:1. Present your bodies as a living sacrifice. You see, Romans had all seen a living sacrifice go from life to death. And they understood this metaphor maybe better than we do. Caesar Augustus himself presided over this altar and the sacrifice. You can see the ram, the boar, and the oxen lined up ready for sacrificing. Italians have enclosed this Arapaces in this huge clear glass building. It's beautiful, but it's rather creepy when you realize what's being celebrated here. The lust for entertainment was deep in the Roman world, and that entertainment meant bloodshed. At the races, in the circus, or in combat in the Colosseum. And every Roman town had a Colosseum. When the Emperor Vespasian destroyed Jerusalem in 70 AD, you know about that, 20,000 Jews were brought to Rome in chains as slave labor to build the Colosseum. The Colosseum was financed by the looting of the Temple of Jerusalem. Titus Justus celebrates this in his arch. You can see them carrying out the candlestick of the Temple of Jerusalem. All of the gold from the temple was chopped up and sold, and that's how they paid for it. The Colosseum was built by Jews, financed by the looting of the temple. On the walls of the Colosseum, in writing, it says, built by the spoils of the Jewish war. Every stone of this structure was cut, fitted, and paid for by Jewish captives from Jerusalem. Vespasian built the Colosseum to keep the people happy in their lust for entertainment. On the opening day of the games in 79 AD, 50,000 people gathered and hundreds of criminals fought to the death as a warm-up to the professional gladiator fights to come. Trap doors in the floor of the amphitheater would pop open and savage tigers lunge out at men. Human and animal blood ran 12 inches deep in the sand. Writers comment on the sheer volume of noise from people cheering in hopes that one man would die over another. Like everything else in the ancient world, this was built on money, gambling, power, lust, feeling of victory. The Colosseum's sole purpose was to win support of the people, and the people obtained pleasure by watching death and suffering.
human death was the highest entertainment. The Beastmaster trained lions and tigers to eat people. Big cats were fed human flesh so that they would learn to like the taste of it. This cell in the second tier of the Colosseum has Christian graffiti written on the wall, or Christian messages written on the wall. It's likely that Christians were held here before being led into the arena. Animals would be held there first so that the humans would pick up their scent and smell and be more enticing to the large cats to whom they would be prey. Jailers would use long trident pitchforks to stab at the Christians and make them bloody, and again, making them more interesting to the large cats in the Colosseum. Gladiators were the superstars of the ancient world. They were trained in schools to fight and combine showmanship with fighting technique for the pleasure of their audience. Sworn by an oath to die bravely, the more wild and violent the battle of ripping each other to shreds, the better the entertainment value. Gladiators often wore masks to impersonate the Roman gods, Jupiter or Neptune, and imitate them taking vengeance on this barbarian. Winning one bout as a gladiator would equal a Roman soldier's salary for a year. There was a special women's section high in the arena. Roman women became obsessed with gladiators. Superstars, they called them, and they paid large sums of money to be with men sexually who might die in the arena the next day. At home parties, like we would hire, people call me sometimes, they want to hire a singer or hire a pianist for a home party. They would hire gladiators to fight to the death to entertain their guests. The pagan writer Seneca wrote, "Rome was a cesspool of iniquity." Let me translate that for you. Rome was a sewer of sin. And he was a pagan. So, imagine you live in the year 100 AD and you go with another woman to a late night meeting in a tituli or a back room that was used as a church meeting house with another Christian woman. You hear about the love of God and you make the choice to obey, like Paul or Cornelius or Lydia did. Be baptized. Change your life. How do you survive daily living? You come out of the waters of baptism and you have to return to your life. To a master who abuses you, a mistress who beats you, to long hours of service and sleeping on a stone floor, and you hear, "Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind." We have to undergo a dramatic change. Our innermost personality has to change from being self-centered to Christ-centered. The mind of Christ is now available to us. Every breath, every motion, every word we get to offer as our spiritual worship to God. What's the purpose of me being here? Take everything that you do, the dishwashing and the scrubbing and the everyday life and the working and the serving, and do it to the glory of God. Let's look at Romans 12:14. Imagine being in a late night meeting and hearing these words. "Bless those who persecute you and do not curse them. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Weep with those who weep. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be haughty, but associate with the lowly. Never be conceited." I think about a slave who has become a member of the church, leading a prayer before his congregation, sitting right next to a patrician who may have become a member of the Lord's church. Look at verse 17. "Repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all. If possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God. For it is written, 'Vengeance is mine, I will repay,' says the Lord. To the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink, for by so doing you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. This is a huge contrast for people who prayed to their idol gods to exact vengeance on their enemies. Here's the evidence. The early Christians really did it. The writings of the era show it. The church in Rome exploded. There is evidence of more than 25 tituli, or home congregations, in Rome. By the year 150 AD, there were an estimated 15,000 Christians in Rome. By 250 AD, there were 30,000 Christians in Rome. Guess how many there are now? The Lord's Church meets in a storefront and has about 30 members. We had to take the metro and two buses to get there. They're always amazed that we can find them because they're way out in the northeast part of the city. There are about 30 members. Next one, Sally. This is one of our sisters in Christ. Her daughter, her granddaughter is with her, and her granddaughter is smiling because she found out our names are very similar. Hers is Katarina, mine Kathleen. This is Brother Vittorio Vitoloni, preacher for this congregation, with his wife and daughter. He told us many of the brethren suffer significant persecution from their families and their employers because they're not Roman Catholic. The early Christians of the Roman world wanted to be different from the people around them. They did not want to blend in. The evidence of the writings from the era is that they obeyed the teachings of Jesus and the apostles literally. When they worshiped, they had a lesson. They read the Old Testament and the letters, and they had the Lord's Supper, and they sang, and with their sincere, loving faith, they converted people. One pagan writer wrote about Christians. They abstain from all pleasures. They do not attend sporting events. They have no interest in public amusements. They reject the public banquets and abhor the sacred games. America used to be known as a Christian nation. These Christians could not even conceive of a time when most people were honest or moral, as were the times my mother grew up in. Roman Christians were surrounded with every combination of filth. And just studying the words of Jesus and transforming their hearts, they changed. They turned their lives to breathe in and out for the Lord. They stood out as being different. Are we criticized for being different? Do we stand out in our devotion to God? The early Christians embraced this. Lives that went against Roman culture instead of following it. Justin Martyr, and he's called that for a reason, in 150 AD, he wrote this: "We who used to value the acquisition of wealth and possessions more than anything else now bring what we have into a common fund and share it with anyone who needs it. We used to hate and destroy one another and refuse to associate with people of another race or country. Now, because of Christ, we live together with such people and pray for our enemies." When plague swept across the ancient world in the 3rd century, Christians were the only ones who cared for the sick. Pagans were throwing their infected family members out in the street while they were still alive. Christians took them and cared for them. Remember Romans 12:1? Present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. What your bodies do, your sacrificial living, is your service to God. It's no wonder Christianity spread throughout the ancient world without any technology. Have you seen the commercial that's out right now for the darling little children in Africa, and they're given free laptops, and they open them up and they say, "Now we have hope for the future."
I'm sorry. The gospel of Jesus Christ is our hope for the future. Amen. The love the early Christians practiced drew the attention of the world, just as Jesus said it would. They acted differently. They dressed differently. Listen to Clement of Alexandria in the year 210 AD. Listen to what he writes here. Luxurious clothing that cannot conceal the shape of the body is no covering at all. Such clothing clinging close to the body takes the body's shape and adheres to the flesh. It outlines the woman's figure so that the whole shape of her body is visible to spectators. Even though they cannot see the body itself, such clothing is meant for looking, not for covering. Could it be any clearer than that? And they had the same problem in 210 AD that we have now. The church emphasized principles of simple, modest dress, principles, and left the specifics up to the individual Christian. Christians avoided the public baths, which were so much a part of Roman culture. They taught that men and women should not dress immodestly in each other's presence. Listen to the brilliant Tertullian from the year 200 AD. He wrote about vile language and attitudes. How can it be right to look at things that are wrong to do? How can those things which defile a man when they go out of his mouth not defile him when going in through his eyes and ears? And Tertullian did not even have television beaming into his home. Remember, these Christians lived in times we cannot fathom. Persecution came in waves as emperors and governors changed their mind about enforcing laws. As we return from our break, we're going to learn more about the extent to which these Christians gave their whole lives to the Lord. Before we go to break, I want to, would you mind turning that light on for me? Thank you. I want to share a couple very exciting things with you. You'll notice on your handout I put a website. It's an actual sign-in. Perhaps some of you do like I do. I know the Pleasant Hill Congregation started with these one-year Bibles, and they have it in the ESV version, which many of us enjoy and use. These are wonderful. You can get them as inexpensively as $10 online at ESV.org, $10. But that actual sign-in will bring you to a daily email of a one-year Bible study. You will get an email every day with Old Testament, New Testament, Psalms, and Proverbs. You can get it on your phones or your computers, whatever you want, and you will be able to read through the entire Bible in a year, either using one of these, or if you want to, log in with that website. I thought I would share it with you if you're interested. The other thing is, how many of you know what a TV Guardian is? Does anyone know what TV Guardian is? All right, good, good, good. Well, I called the people at TV Guardian. It's back up in print. We have them coming faithfully from Arkansas now. My opinion is this is probably the best $109 you will spend for your family other than investments in your Bibles if you have a television in your home. I am technologically ignorant, as some people will attest. See my granddaughter nodding her head. If I can hook it up, you can hook it up. So cable goes in here. This goes into your television. And it eliminates foul language from most programs. You get a little subtitle that says something acceptable, like if some movies or something will say what the something, it just says what and a question mark on that subtitle, and then it goes back to the regular movie. It's wonderful for shows like, take a movie like Night at the Museum, which is a perfectly fun adventure movie, but there's a couple bad words in it. I don't want to hear them. I'm not interested in hearing them. This will just eliminate those two words, and it'll say, what, with a question mark? And it's a wonderful investment. So I called them, and I said, is it okay if I reproduce your flyer, which gives you $20 off on a TV Guardian? And they said, well, you know, tell me about your event and things like that. I said, well, there'll be a bunch of Christian ladies gathered, and we'll be talking about the Bible. He said, why don't I send you one, and you can have a drawing for a free TV Guardian. So I've got some little pieces of paper here, and if you're interested, I want you to come up and put in your name. We'll have a drawing at lunchtime and give away this free TV Guardian. And I can show you how to hook it up. And if any of you get one and don't know, call me. You can actually call them. The man is so nice. He'll walk you through it. I had trouble with one thing, and it's just a wonderful tool.
if you have a television in your home, please, please, please do this for your spirit. It's a wonderful thing to do. So there's flyers for everyone and pieces to fill out and put in our little bowl here for our drawing. And I think that's it for now. Yeah, whoever doesn't have a TV, thumbs up.